Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. Thank you for being here with us this morning. Before we call the case, I want to go over a little bit about the new courtroom technology that we've got, and then we'll call the case and get started. I guess it's not new at this point. We're about a year into this, but we are now capable of live streaming in this courtroom, and we will be live streaming the argument this morning. The link is available on the Court of Appeals website. We have a setup here where our microphones are set to record and pick up everything that's spoken in the courtroom. There's a white light and a red light on the microphones. If it's white, it's a hot mic, and it will pick up everything and record, transcribe everything that you're saying. If it's red, it's muted, and it won't, but there's a button on the device to override that. Same thing for up here when you're at the podium with us. And so the technology that we have also populates a real-time transcript, which is really useful to us on appeal. So just when you're up here presenting to us, make sure that you're speaking into the microphone so that we get a clear record of everything that we're saying today. With that, we're very happy to have you with us. We have a lot of questions for you this morning, so I'm going to go ahead and call the case. We're here today on the matter of State versus Howard, case number A1CA42236. May we have entries of appearance, please?
Sheriff Rose of the State. Chief Darnell of Patrick Howard, honor.
Mr. Arona, I understand you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you very much. All right, counsel. Are we all ready for the recording? Great. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Arona.
May it please the court. This case asks whether a district court has the authority to release a sex offender earlier than the legislature has mandated in a sentencing statute. The answer to that question is no. In this case, defendant pled guilty to criminal sexual contact of a minor in the third degree, an enumerated sex offense, and he received a conditional discharge. Under the sex offender probation statute, any defendant who pleads guilty to that offense shall serve not less than 5 years of supervised probation. Here, after serving less than 3 years on probation, the district court terminated defendant's probation early and discharged his criminal case. That ruling violated the legislature's mandatory sentencing statute. This court should reverse the district court's order denying the state's motion to reinstate probation for the remainder of the 5-year statutory floor. And with that, I understand the court submitted some questions, so I'm just going to kind of walk through the four questions, and please interrupt me if you want to go in a different direction. But starting with the threshold question of whether the state has a right to appeal. Yes, here the state has a constitutional right to appeal as an aggrieved party. Under Grostet, Horton, and Aguilar, those authorities support the state's right to appeal here, because what happened in this case is once the state filed its motion to reinstate probation, the district court denied that motion. But when it denied that motion, the district court made a finding that the conditional discharge statute does not incorporate the sex offender probation statute. And so because that's a mandatory sentencing statute and a violation of a sentencing statute, that gives the valid claim that the state has a right to appeal here under the Constitution.
Assuming that we were to agree with you that there is a right to appeal by the state under these circumstances, my question is, what is the time frame that governs that right? Here we have a sentence that was imposed 3 years before the probation was modified. And so that's the time period when the illegal sentence was imposed. What time frames govern the state's ability to raise the illegal sentence issue?
Well, our appellate courts are very clear that an illegal sentence can be raised at any time. Now, this is for the state's right to appeal.
That's on appeal, but how do you get the matter to us on appeal? What's the vehicle for doing that? So my understanding of the cases that we have is that there was an appeal timely taken within 30 days of a final order, and then this court can address the issue, but I'm not certain what boundaries govern the state's right to raise it in the district court.
Oh, in the district court. Oh, yeah. So in the district court, our appellate courts have stated that a district court has the authority to correct its sentence, and that's Romero.
But the Romero rule modified 5801 and put a 30-day bumper on that, and we're outside of that 30-day bumper.
Well, we're outside of the 30-day bumper for the district court here. For the district court, I think in that 30-day time frame, I think the state filed its motion in the within 50 days. I think what makes this case unique is that the state not only filed its motion to reinstate probation, but it also filed a writ with the Supreme Court. And in that writ, 5 days later, the Supreme Court actually issued a stay on the order. And then it ultimately denied the state's writ, but it did order the district court to hear our motion, to hear the motion to reinstate probation. So I think that kind of brings us outside that timeline, because we're dealing with a writ here where the Supreme Court actually ordered the district court to hear our motion to reinstate probation.
So even if you were too late to bring the motion under the rule, the Supreme Court ordered the district court to consider it anyway.
Exactly, yes.
And so then moving from there, your aggrieved party argument gives us jurisdiction, or gives you the right to the appeal and us jurisdiction to hear it?
Correct, yes.
My question has to do with what the illegal sentence actually is, mm-hmm. because one of your arguments was that the basis for your right to appeal was that you keep saying you can correct an illegal sentence at any time. Your brief suggested that the illegal sentence is the termination, that we like sort of look backwards at what the sentence turned out to be after the termination, and that sentence was illegal. Is there an argument that the sentence was illegal from the outset?
No. Because the conditional discharge, or the JNS in this case, it actually complied with the statutory floor. The defendant was originally sentenced to 5 years of supervised probation. The termination was a modification of that. So here we have a JNS saying you're going to complete 5 years of supervised probation, but the district court actually modified that sentence when it just terminated the probation. And because we're dealing with the conditional discharge, the district court actually just terminated the entire case.
I just want to follow up, because you're saying no pretty affirmatively on the fact that you don't think that the initial sentence wasn't a legal one, saying that it was 5 years. But the statutory language indicates that it's 5 to 20. We have cases like State v. Cooley that affirmatively note, right, that you have to have all of those different hearings to move forward to determine whether or not you need to stay on probation up to 20 years under the statute. So how is this an initial sentence that flatlines at 5, that ignores the statutory language requiring up to 20 and all of those necessary hearings, a legal sentence?
Right, and I didn't mean to say no like that affirmatively. I think that the narrow distinction is that the JNS did comply with the statutory floor. Your Honor, you're correct. The 5 to 20 indeterminate period should have been listed in the JNS by the statute. But that kind of brings us squarely within Romero, where now we're talking about, if this court finds that it was an illegal sentence, that the defendant would have an opportunity to withdraw. The sentence was not illegal. It's mostly that when it's remanded, that the defendant can actually withdraw his plea, and then we kind of get into knowing and voluntary in that sense. And so the illegal sentence through the JNS did hit the statutory floor, and whether or not this indeterminate 5 to 20 after the statutory sentencing statute applies within the JNS, and whether it was written in the JNS, I think that kind of gets us into what the defendant, you know, pled to and was knowing and voluntary, and that kind of gets us in a different realm.
And say that's a realm that we want to get into.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think that brings us to Romero. I think that brings us to Romero, and Romero was very unique in that sense that there was a habeas petition. And so the record right here doesn't show, you know, whether the defendant knew that it was a 5 to indeterminate. I don't know if there's any email exchanges between the prosecutor and the defendant of what the defendant actually knew and volunteered, but that's why maybe a habeas proceeding or the evidentiary hearing would be better to resolve those questions rather than this court here.
Well, counsel, doesn't the plea agreement note the statutory requirement yes, the plea agreement says 5 years, but underneath it notes, right, the 5 to 20. Then there's the portion where the judge also signs saying that the defendant in this case is aware of the statutory minimum and maximum of 5 to 20. So it's in multiple places within the plea agreement.
Yes, it is in that boilerplate kind of language that the court runs through, but it does have that qualifier that if the court suspends any portion of the sentence, and that's not what happened in this case. So when we're talking about a suspended sentence, it actually did. That if the court suspends any portion of the sentence, defendant shall serve an indeterminate period of supervised probation of not less than 5 years and up to 20 years. So that was in the plea agreement. So that wasn't the plea agreement, but we weren't really dealing with a suspended sentence, that we were dealing with a conditional discharge.
But doesn't State v. Leslie suggest that we were dealing somewhat with a suspended sentence, that that under the general probation terms, terminating probation early, not under the sex offender statute, but the general statute, terminating probation early is considered suspension of a sentence in some respect?
Sure, yeah, and Leslie's a good case because this court definitely expressly said that the conditional discharge incorporates all the probation statutes is what it said. And so expressly incorporating those, it did kind of put them on an equal playing field. But I think in that case, the conditional discharge, they were trying to increase it, and this court wanted a level playing field with a conditional discharge, a suspended sentence, and a deferred sentence.
I still have a few questions about the procedure for the state to raise this issue. It's not clear to me what the rule allows, either under the prior version that was in effect at the time the district court made this decision, or the amended version that went into effect last year of 5801, 802, and 803, all seem to contemplate that the motion to correct an illegal sentence would be brought by the defendant. There's really nothing in there talking about the state's right. And in Tafoya and other cases that were decided under the prior version of 801 before the Supreme Court issued its Romero opinion, there was some discussion in those opinions about how the state's right to seek or to correct an illegal sentence was limited to sentences imposed in an illegal manner. Now, I know Romero abrogated the prior case, Tafoya and its progeny, but I'm wondering about the state's right to appeal. How does the state raise the issue of an illegal sentence, and what rules govern the state's ability to do that in a normal case? I understand your position that this is an outlier, but this is going to come up again. And how do we write about the procedure that the state's to follow in order to raise this issue in the first place?
I think Perez can guide this court, because what we're talking about is a sub issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And I think our courts have been very clear that what we're talking about in a legal sentence, this is a sentence that is null and void on arrival. Basically, when that termination happened, the district court acted without authority. And so whenever we're dealing with an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, that brings us into that issue cannot be waived, and I think for good reason. I mean, we're talking, like, here's a slippery slope argument that if a defendant, a defense attorney, a prosecutor, and a judge all get together and want to put somebody who's convicted of a fourth degree felony to 100 years in prison, that has to be litigated. That can't just shut down this court and be like, well, after that, like, this is an illegal sentence, but it was within, you know, 50 years later, we can't hear it because of that. I think we're talking about due process concerns, and I think that's why our appellate courts are so concerned with whether the district court acts within its authority, which only comes from the sentence.
So, taking that to the next logical step, what's the outer limit for the state to raise subject matter jurisdiction? Is it before the sentence that the illegal sentence has expired? Is it before the sentence that should have been imposed? Can it be raised after the defendant has completed the sentence?
The state's position is yes, to open this court's doors, for this court to hear this case. Yes, an illegal sentence can be raised at any time. However, when we're getting down the road with 50 years, you know, how many years, now we're getting into double jeopardy concerns. Now we're getting about whether, you know, the state wins on these cases because, you know, we're talking about the expeditious right. But
I think the frustration we're having is that there is a vehicle, there's a specific vehicle for a defendant to do this under the rules. You have 30 days to do it sort of as of right. And then after that, there's a habeas petition. There's a separate proceeding for defendants to use to get counsel, to work its way through the courts and to present the issue to the district court. And it seems like the way the state has presented it here is that the state can show up on its own, you know, representing itself as it does, anytime, and just file a motion and have it be considered in the same way as any other motion without all the procedural hoops that a defendant has to go through to defend himself against a against this kind of, or to protect him or herself against this kind of illegal sentence. And the concern is that with a habeas petition, you don't get counsel right away, right? With a habeas petition, you have to demonstrate the right to counsel. And so if the state just comes in at any point, 5 years, 10 years down the road, and says, no, we did it wrong, how is the defendant protected? And what is the mechanism for the state to use that puts it on equal footing with the defendant?
And I hear the court's concern. I think that's a larger question that this court doesn't have to get to here, because we're dealing with a writ. And the Supreme Court ordered the district court to hear our motion.
So do you think writ practice is the answer? A writ is the answer for the state when it's past the 30 days?
It could be. It could be. And then other than that, it's the constitutional right as an aggrieved party disposition. And I kind of illuminated the concerns of an illegal sentence, whether it comes to the state's attention or the defense, you know, defense's attention, that there's an illegal sentence, oh, this person shouldn't be incarcerated, and we messed up. Everyone messed up. Everyone missed that. So I think to open this court's doors, I do think the Constitution as an aggrieved party, as the state as an aggrieved party, any issue when it's a disposition contrary to law. And Horton really narrows it down. It's when a statute is violated, a mandatory statute is violated, an issue of a public importance, and then whether, I think the other one is a state's strong interest in enforcing statutes.
And I think your focus is on opening this court's doors,
yes.
But I think that we're talking about how to get this started in the district court when you're past 30 days.
Right.
Does Section E of 801 apply at all?
I'm not familiar really with 801.3. I know it's in Romero.
The mandatory sentence.
5801 states mandatory sentence. The rule does not apply to the death penalty or a mandatory sentence.
Then yes. Yeah, I think
I have no idea how to reconcile that with an illegal sentence, because we have several examples of illegal sentence cases where it's based on the failure of a district court to impose a mandatory sentence. So I don't know how to reconcile those provisions of 801.
And we don't have any case law actually applying it as far as we're aware of.
Sure, and I think the distinction between the, because yeah, there can be different types of illegal sentences. There can be, you know, within the general probation statute, if you put somebody on probation for 5 years and one day, is it a mandatory statute? Here, this is a clear mandatory statute. So I do think there are some different ways to kind of interpret what the distinction between a mandatory sentence versus just an improper sentence, even like the probation requirements. But because of that exception that I've heard, you know, I think we're dealing with that exception here, because it is a mandatory statute. I know I get into it in the briefs. But here, the legislature was clear with its intent. Sex offenders pose a significant risk of recidivism. Therefore, they will be put on mandatory restrictions. They will be put on they will get sex offender treatment. And because we're dealing with in this world where the legislature was so clear that we want to treat sex offenders differently because of that risk of recidivism, the treatment that they get, that's a significant hurdle to kind of jump in. And I believe that's why it's such a mandatory, you know, sentencing statute. It takes it away from the district court's authority.
In terms of the double jeopardy implications of this procedure and what the state's asking us to do, walk us through how you view the double jeopardy problem in this case and how we can resolve it. My concerns are that the sentence was, per the district court's order, terminated by the order discharging the defendant from probation. And so what's the defendant's expectation of finality at that point? And how does reinstating probation implicate double jeopardy?
Sure. I'll start with the broader picture of, like, our federal courts. The U.S. Constitution, in U.S. v. Boza, they've declared that there's no objective reasonable expectation of finality in an illegal sentence, because for the same reason it's null and void. But narrowing it closer here, Red House, I think, is the right case to kind of focus on for the double jeopardy concern. So for Red House, it really brought it out of the realm of other sentences, other improper sentences, and really dealt with an illegal sentence. And whether or not the defendant has an objective, reasonable expectation of finality depends on how fast the state moved. In that case, the state moved 6 days. Here, we moved about 50 days. But again, we have the writ process. You know, I think that's pretty quick to get a writ to the Supreme Court. Plus,
but here we also have almost an affirmative, I mean, like, it was an acquiescence, whatever you want to call it, that happened. How does the state's behavior from the time the motion to terminate was filed until the 46 days after it was granted, how does that not weigh more heavily in the double jeopardy analysis?
Well, I think it's because we're dealing, that's certainly, we're not running away from that fact. Somebody should have objected there. The state should have said something at that, at the hearing where it was terminated, and the victim should have been present as well, which was part of our writ practice. But I think Red House is clear with whatever behavior it is, it's really the expeditiousness of it. When somebody says, oops, we made a mistake, and then they try to rectify it within that day was 6 days. I think in Romero, the district court on its own, 13 days later, issued its own thing. And so this is without the parties present as well. Like the district court in Romero, 13 days later, amended the JNS, and that was still illegal as well. And so with Romero and Red House, I think to get through the double jeopardy concerns, really depends on if this court determines that the state acted expeditiously here.
Does it matter to you that in the first two examples that you cited, both of those modifications occurred within the window for appealing?
Red House does mention that it was within the realm of appealing. But as we've heard, and I know this court has concerns, I think the state was in the realm of appealing here. We're talking about the writ practice that gave this case a new life, if you will. And so we are within that appeal period here. And as the state does have a constitutional right to appeal this case, that's the state's position. So,
did the defendant have a reasonable expectation of being released before the 5 years?
No. I think that goes back to the original JNS. He was sentenced to 5 years on the JNS. I think once the motion practice flew they had held the hearing, I think about between 2.5 and 3 years, that was just kind of a wish. There was no expectation that the defendant was going to be placed off of the 5 years of probation because he hadn't served it yet, and that was what he was sentenced to originally.
And there was no language in the plea agreement that would indicate an early release, correct?
Correct. That is correct. And so I think Romero and Red House, for the double jeopardy concern, kind of show this pathway here. For this court to kind of get over those hurdles. So I think what's also interesting about Romero, they were dealing with an illegal sentence here. Double jeopardy is really not mentioned in that opinion at all. They just went to due process concerns for the defendant, allow him to withdraw the plea. If the defendant didn't know that it was an indeterminate, in that case, 5 to life here, 5 to 20, give the defendant an opportunity, because that's between the defendant and his defense attorney, whether, you know, they want the plea. The Supreme Court of Romero didn't just blow up the plea. They didn't, you know, say this was illegal on void. They allowed the defendant an opportunity to withdraw.
And what do you think the right version of remand would look like? Does it look like remand for an evidentiary hearing and the opportunity to withdraw, or does it look like remand for entry of a sentence appropriate with the statute?
Both. Because that's exactly what Romero did. So in Romero, they found that was an illegal sentence. It should have been 5 to life, the parole term. They said that was a violation of the statute, so correct it. District court, you correct that statute. This defendant particularly is facing 5 to life. Next, step two, give this defendant, now knowing that information, give the defendant an opportunity to withdraw that plea.
So in this case, what would that language look like?
It would look like we hold, putting myself in your shoe, this court holds that it was an illegal sentence, that the conditional discharge statute for sex offenders does trigger the sex offender probation statute. You can't get out of that. There's no release valve there. Anybody who's convicted of an enumerated sex offense with the conditional discharge does have to serve a minimum 5 years, indeterminate 5 to 20, with opportunities after that with probation hearings to get out of to get released early, depending on the probation board. And then also, consistent with Romero, the defendant has an opportunity to withdraw his plea based on this new information or based on the information that it was an illegal sentence and that he is now facing an indeterminate period of 20 and to finish his sex offender probation treatment. Because I think that's what kind of distinguishes that, kind of gets us into the mootness part, is the legislature was so clear that that sex offenders need sex offender treatment. And so that's what was not happening after the case was terminated. So there was no treatment that the defendant was receiving. And as our legislature has, posed, that's the concern they have, is they want treatment and then they want an indeterminate 5 to 20, let someone review this case and then make a determination for the defendant.
A great deal of our case law suggests that you cannot go back on a sentence once it's been fully served, that we can't pull someone back in and make them do more time. In this case, probation was terminated. It was over. Is that, as far as defendant knew at that time, is that sufficient to invoke that case law that says we can't go back once it's been fully served?
No, and I think it's the illegal sentence part. The case law is clear. An illegal sentence is null and void. And
I guess,
so,
is it really fully served? Because some of our case law says even an irregular sentence cannot be set aside. Even an illegal sentence cannot be set aside if it's been fully served.
And I think I know what cases you're talking about. Those are generally in the habitual offender enhancement statutes. But in those cases, the person is usually incarcerated, serves that time period, and then the state afterwards tries to enhance it with a viable habitual offender.
After like a probation violation or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
Right, so they're still on probation.
Right.
And we're increasing the original sentence.
Correct, but here the probation was just terminated.
Right.
And so and if that termination is illegal, then he didn't finish his term.
I guess there's differences in both respects, right? Because in those habitual offender cases, probation was still ongoing, so they were still serving something. But because the habitual offender was increasing the basic sentence, you were going backwards to increase the sentence. So that's different than now. But what we do have here is an end to the court imposing an end to serving the sentence at all. And does that termination implicate the same kinds of concerns?
I see my time, if I could just answer that. Yeah, it does, and I think it's because we're dealing with an illegal sentence here with specifically a mandatory statute, and I think that's what kind of brings us out of there. We have a mandatory statute that says sex offenders pose a significant risk of recidivism, so they should be, the floor is 5 and indeterminate to 20, and because that was cut short, that illegal sentence that the district court imposed here, we still have remedy, we still have relief, to finish the 5-year period, to finish, to the indeterminate of 20.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not to be too presumptuous, but I assume I'm next.
If you want to be. And we'll add about a minute to your time to equalize the...
No problem. Thank you. I'll have a minute to set up here real quick, and I'll be off. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. This is my first time here, so I appreciate the invitation to come speak to you about this case that has been going on for forever. Between the time that the court issued its order setting this oral argument and today, I tried a murder case, and so I'm a little bit late in getting ready for this. I was getting ready this week and kept thinking a couple of things. One, why in the world do they want to talk to us? We briefed this ad nauseum at the Supreme Court, the district court, and here. And then this week I was looking at the questions presented, and I kept thinking, what am I missing? And then it finally dawned on me, I think I know what I'm missing. I think question 1 and question 4 really govern the analysis for the court today and in this case. Does the state have a right to appeal
And is double jeopardy implicated in these proceedings? So you've got all the briefing, but I have sort of taken a new angle, and if I need to brief that with supplemental briefing, I will. But the court's question in number four kept me up many nights this week because I kept wondering, what did I miss? So I looked at Section 39-3-3C of the New Mexico statutes in line with question four, and it the state has not argued that it has a statutory basis for appeal, so subsections A and B do not apply. Subsection C prohibits an appeal by the state when the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution or the Constitution of New Mexico prohibit further prosecution. As every lawyer has done, we go down a rabbit trail, not sure whether we're going to find something, and I came across an unpublished case from this court, State v. Powers. That is NM App unpublished Lexis 340 and 2013 Westlaw 666-2712.
You have the Court of Appeals case number, the five-digit?
I could not find it. I will try and find that again. I was looking on Lexis, which is how I got down that trail.
State versus Powers?
Powers, yes, ma'am.
Could you give the Westlaw number one more time?
2013 WL 666 2712.
It's A1CA 32207.
Thank you. The good part is I'm not really going to talk about Powers. Powers gives a historical analysis of double jeopardy case law similar to some of the cases cited in the briefs. But it sends us down what is the double jeopardy analysis. It cites the State versus Lovato, 2007 NMCA 49, at paragraph 6, for the proposition that has already been mentioned, that once a sentence has been served, a defendant's punishment for the crime has come to an end. It also cites the State v. Red House, which has already been discussed here today, at paragraph 10, for double jeopardy concerns are only implicated if the defendant has an objectively reasonable expectation of finality in the sentence. It also cites the State v. Red House for the proposition that increasing a defendant's sentence after the defendant begins serving the sentence implicates double jeopardy concerns if a defendant's objectively reasonable expectation of finality in the original sentencing proceedings are violated.
So, counsel, that's where I have one of my main questions that I asked opposing counsel at State, which is, did your client have a reasonable expectation to be released earlier than 5 years based off the objective plain reasoning of the plea agreement?
I believe he did. Number one, and I don't mean to stray too far, but I've had the same question. Number one, generally when the 5 to 20 probation issue is in play, that's not only put in as mandatory language in a plea agreement, it's also put in mandatory language in the JNS. And here, it was boilerplate language, as opposing counsel mentioned, that it could apply. The maximum sentence could be this. It was never mandatorily imposed in either the plea agreement or the JNS.
Does the plea agreement know anything that the defendant would be eligible for an early termination of probation?
No, but frankly, I've never seen a plea agreement that says you are eligible or ineligible. I think the default is that if someone behaves, and the district court cited to this in its order releasing Mr. Howard from probation, in its order denying the state's motion to reinstate probation, is that the probation department regulations have an affirmative duty to release someone if they've completed everything that's been required of them. And I'm doing that one from memory, so.
But is that true in cases where someone has been convicted or pled to an enumerated sex offense, that you have that reasonable expectation of early release just sort of if you behave?
I was going to get to that. Nobody in this case has ever cited to a case that says someone who pleads to a conditional discharge for this offense, criminal sexual contact of a minor, is affirmatively required to serve the 5 to 20. And I think that plays into the double jeopardy analysis as well. If there was a case that existed that said that, somebody would have found it.
Do we need a case if the statute's pretty heavily suggested?
I would think so, because I think the case law is, as is all case law, you can find a case for either side most times. And here, the cases I cited on the state's right to appeal and whether the sex offender statutes, probation statutes apply, directly contradict the state's cases. I mean, there are cases that I cited that say that a conditional discharge is different. It isn't the same as regular probation. And if, and I will get back to this, but if you are not given affirmative instructions in the plea agreement or the JNS or the change of plea order, that will, as a foreshadowing, that's where I'm going with the reasonable belief. But if nothing at the front end says that this applies, and you go over halfway through and nobody says it applies, not the probation department, not the judge, not the prosecutor, then obviously no one thought it applied.
Be that as it may, that doesn't fix the fact that it might in fact be an illegal sentence.
Correct.
And the sex offender probation statute very clearly specifies that it applies under circumstances where there's been a plea of guilty, which we have in this case.
You do have a plea of guilty. You don't have a conviction, but you do have a plea of guilty.
Right.
And I could certainly see this court issuing an opinion that says these statutes do apply to a conditional discharge order. This is a case of first impression. Mm-hmm. And getting to the end of my argument, if it is a case of first impression, and we are going to apply these from henceforth to the conditional discharge probationers, then that puts Mr. Howard in a very unique position. I found a case last night, the state v. Alderete, 111 NM 297. If a legislature creates an ex post facto law, that's what ex post facto is. If the court, the judicial system, applies laws retroactively, that's a due process violation. So here, if this court were to say as a matter of first impression, yes, these statutes apply, I think Mr. Howard has a due process right not to have it him applied to him retroactively.
But doesn't that go to whether to allow him to withdraw his plea rather than and to plea knowingly and voluntarily to a not illegal sentence?
I disagree. I could certainly see the reasoning in that.
Because that's the due process remedy that we get from Romero.
From Romero, yes. You also have the issue in Romero where there was a timely objection or timely motion to correct what was already believed to be an illegal sentence. Here, there was no timeliness on the part of the state. They didn't correct it after he pled guilty. They waited 46 days to do anything after he was terminated from probation. So, to the court's questions regarding, was this done? I think it was done.
Had he served his sentence?
Or he had served his sentence by the time he was terminated from probation. That was an order completing the sentence in all effects. And had the state appealed that order or appropriately objected, then I think the issue could be preserved or would have been preserved, and maybe an appeal would be proper under those circumstances. But as a criminal defense attorney, I can't tell you the number of times I've read a case from every court of appeals I've ever practiced in front of that says, sorry, you failed to object. That point of error is waived.
But don't we have the intervening writ from the Supreme Court that said, I mean, in that moment, that was the opportunity for the Supreme Court to say, yeah, it was waived. Go about your business. And what they said instead was, no, consider the state's motion and let it go through the process. So it seems like the part where we are concerned about the lack of objection has been already addressed by our Supreme Court.
Maybe I read the court's order wrong. What I saw the Supreme Court's order to mean, because the writ went up on the failure to abide by the victim rights issues, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the statute, but
I think it's the Victims' Rights Act or something like that.
Something, yeah. Yes, I was close. That was the main issue that went up, was there was no affirmative finding or at the district court that act had been complied with. So the remedy they fashioned to send it back for a hearing on the state's motion to reinstate, I took to mean you have to make sure that the Victims' Rights Act is complied with, and here's a hearing in order to do that.
So if we were following that line of argument, you're saying the writ does not absolve the state from the requirement to file an appeal within 30 days, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, and so what then? If we have no appeal within 30 days. We
correct.
Have a writ that creates some ambiguity in what we're allowed to review.
Correct.
Where does that leave us?
I think, I can get rid of the last 18 minutes and just say I think we're done and Mr. Howard goes free, but I think the court probably wants a little bit more analysis. I think if we look at this, back to where I was kind of going, if we look at this right to appeal through the double jeopardy lens, I think it's clear that the state's argued right to appeal constitutionally versus defendant's constitutional rights under double jeopardy and due process are really what is the main confrontation to be considered in this appeal. I think nobody said the word and nobody really likes the word, but opposing counsel said if you get 50, 60 years down the road, all of a sudden we have weird implications. Well, I think at some point, latches has to apply. At some point, you can't just come back and say, well, every person who we missed is still subject to our criminal justice system. There has to be a sense of fairness in the proceedings.
But hasn't that been, in that end time, been considered to be the termination of the sentence? When you're done serving your sentence, the state can't come back and add more time.
Yes, and he finished the sentence that, I mean,
right.
He didn't finish the 5 years, but we did file a motion for early termination that was granted,
right.
And nobody did anything.
So what, procedurally, what is the effect of that early discharge from probation? Is that a sentence modification? How do we characterize that under law and rule?
I think it is the completion of the sentence. I disagree with the state that it is a sentence of in and of itself. That question two from this court was the early discharge from probation in the legal sentence? A termination of a sentence, I don't believe, is a sentence. Sentence is what happens at the beginning and any modifications thereafter. If you are on probation and revoked and sent to prison, that is a subsequent sentence, an amended sentence of sorts.
It supersedes the original.
It supersedes the original. This is not a sentence. This is the termination. So it can't be a sentence.
But the original sentence is 5 years. And so isn't the early termination a modification of that condition in the JNS?
In a non-legal sense, I would agree it's a modification. But I think termination is different than modification. I think termination has a sense of finality in it that the defendant relies upon to say, I did what I was supposed to do, I behaved, I'm done with whatever my punishment is, whether that's 5 years in prison, 20 years in prison, 5 years on probation, or 20 years on probation. Whenever you're done, you're done.
How does subsection E of 801 interplay with this?
I didn't hear the
language for being a mandatory sentence and not needing a time frame? If that's the case, how does subsection E of 801 apply?
I'm not understanding the court's question. Sorry.
So we're talking about
Rule 5801.
Rule 5801, right. And subsection E says this 30 days does not apply if it's a mandatory sentence. And so understanding, right, that the termination occurred 46 days later, how long does the state have to do that? How does the mandatory sentence language play in all of this?
If I may, to answer that question, can we assume the sex offender statutes don't apply, just for argument's sake? If the sex offender statutes don't apply, there is nothing in the New Mexico rules that prohibit a defendant from being released early if he completes the terms and conditions of his probation, or her probation, excuse me. So a mandatory sentence, the 5 years is the mandatory portion that must be considered by a district court. But the rules allow for early termination. In fact, the probation department's own regulations require early termination under certain circumstances. So the mandatory language is the minimum that a defendant can be sentenced to, but it does not mean that a defendant cannot be released early.
So then let's look at the probation statute, right, which then refers to the sex offender statute that says minimum 5 years.
Right, I agree. That's under the assumption that all the parties in the courtroom are working under, that the 5 to 20 probation statute was not in play, that goes to Mr. Howard's reasonable beliefs. If this court were to now say they do apply, I still stand by that is a matter of first impression. As plain as it may seem from the statutes, the judge...
And I understand what you're saying. So I guess my follow-up question to that is it really a case of first impression when we have State v. Leslie that says conditional discharge requires all the same probationary requirements for anybody who's getting a suspended or a deferred sentence? And so we already have that case law in place. And that same statute says refer to sex offender statute XYZ. Does that truly become a case of first impression?
I think it does because I think it's Benz. I'm looking at my brief real fast here. There are Court of Appeals cases and Supreme Court cases saying that, here it is. Yes, Benz. That a conditional discharge, the Court of Appeals wrote that a conditional discharge, on the other hand, is different from a suspended or deferred sentence because there is no adjudication of guilt. So there are cases that say they are the same in some regards, and then other cases that say they're not the same in some regards.
But isn't the problem that the cases that say they're the same are the cases that deal with probation and how probation applies and how to expect probation to apply?
They do. I would agree with that. But they do in a totally different context, generally in whether habitual offender statutes were applied retroactively. I mean, almost the entirety of the case law that was cited to by the state dealt with habitual offender enhancements that were brought after the defendant entered his plea or her plea. This is different. This has nothing to do with habitual offender enhancements. This has nothing to do with anything that is squarely on point with any case from this court or the Supreme Court that looks directly at this issue of a conditional discharge and the sex offender statutes. And there is ambiguity. I mean, I understand the cases that say that there shouldn't be. But I also understand the cases that say that there is a difference. And when there's two lines of cases that differ on that point, on what is the benefit and what is the differences between conditional discharge and the others, I think that creates room for a defendant and even a judge and a prosecutor in this case to believe that they didn't apply. If everybody believed they'd applied, they would have been in the plea agreement, in the judgment sentence, and in the change of plea order. And nowhere was there any mention of those statutes except for in the plea agreement, in the boilerplate language, where it said the maximum penalties are as follows. That doesn't put anybody on notice that they are being subjected to those conditions. That puts you on notice that you could be if you go to trial and lose, but that doesn't say that as a condition of your probation, here you go. I mean, it wasn't even in his conditions of probation.
Counsel, can I ask, have you had multiple cases like this that resulted in conditional discharge in New Mexico?
I'm thinking over 15 years. I believe I've had at least two, maybe more, which then still issue kind of raises the issue of what happens here. I went back and looked at the plea agreement and judgment sentence on a sex offense in New Mexico last night to confirm what my memories were, and the language mandatory that it had to be included in all the paperwork, it was there. In fact, the state's brief, opening brief, the brief in chief, at page 20, they cite to section 31-20-5.2a for the proposition that when a court defers imposition of a sentence for a sex offender or suspends all or any portion of a sentence for a sex offender, the district court shall include a provision in the judgment and sentence that specifically requires the sex offender to serve an indeterminate period of supervised probation for a period of not less than 5 years and not in excess of 20 years. The language is not there.
That sounds like it's when in the JNS, at the outset, the sentence is deferred and we're letting a defendant know, hey, we've deferred this sentence, but this is, as you said before, the potential for what could happen if that goes badly.
Exactly.
What we have here is a later determination to essentially suspend the rest of the sentence or to end the rest of the sentence, to do something. And the district court and you latched on to this suspend or defer language in both the probation statute and the sex offender probation statute and said that's not what's happening here. Suspension is not happening, deferment is not happening, so this statute doesn't apply. And I understand your argument here to be, and that was our reasonable expectation, that because it wasn't a suspension and it wasn't a deferment, that statute wouldn't apply. Is that a mischaracterization of what you're saying?
No, I think that is, I hadn't quite gotten to the expectations and the reasonableness of those expectations, but his expectation, did he have an expectation that one, the sentence was done at the 3 years when we filed the motion to terminate, was granted, and did he have an expectation that he wasn't serving the 5 to 20 probation? If it's not in the JNS, it's not in the plea agreement, and the sex offender statute that I just cited to read from the state's brief says it's mandatory language in the JNS. So if it's not in the JNS that he has to serve this, it's not in the plea agreement, does he have an expectation that that does not apply to him? I think he does.
And I think that was the basis of my question, was the case that you were reading from the state's brief had to do with deferment at the outset.
Correct.
This case is different. It has to do with whatever it was that was happening when probation was terminated. And our problem here is we don't have a word for it, right?
Right.
What is it? Is it a version of suspension? The straight-up probation case law outside the sex offender context suggests that, yeah, it's a suspension. Or it's good enough, it's close enough to a suspension that the normal probation statute language applies, right? And so why wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that the same language in the sex offender statute applies? And so that case says normal probation considered a suspension for the purposes of conditional discharge. So why wouldn't it be reasonable to assume same language in the sex offender statute applies the same way in a conditional discharge?
To the detriment of every client I have going forward, I don't think that's unreasonable. And that's why I think the issue should be decided. But how that implicates Mr. Howard is different than everybody in the future.
Okay.
So what I hear you saying is essentially you don't disagree that the probation statute under the case law was suspended or conditional discharge eventually gets us to the sex offender statute, which says you have a statutory minimum to maximum period of time. What you are saying, though, is that your client didn't have a reasonable expectation for that to apply to him at the time. So if we write it this way, it would be a due process issue to retroactively apply it to him.
Yes, ma'am. I do believe that. Because, no, I don't think that that is an unreasonable finding that, this court could make. Finding that this court can make. But yes, those statutes do apply. I don't like it, but I don't like a lot of things, and that doesn't change the status of the law. But where there is even an argument for ambiguity, as is in this case, if the state believed that these applied, they would have been in the judgment sentence. The state writes the judgment sentence. So,
putting aside what everybody below thought, I think Romero kind of squarely gets at the issue that we're dealing with right here, which is, what is the court's ability to send it back for a modification or correction of what was at the time an illegal judgment and sentence? And Romero doesn't deal with reasonable expectation of finality, and I think that's because they say that the original sentence is a nullity in the first place. And I'm looking at paragraph 32. Mm-hmm. It's null and void. And so instead of dealing with whether or not the defendant had a reasonable expectation of finality in either the original or the second amended judgment and sentence, the court said, we're not going to remand it for imposition of an illegal sentence. We can't do that. It's our job to ensure that the correct sentence is imposed, and so they sent it back to allow the defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea. And so I'm wondering, why isn't that controlling for what we need to do here?
To beat the proverbial dead horse, because I think his sentence was done. That order terminating probation completed his obligations to the state of New Mexico as a criminal defendant.
You don't dispute, though, that the state could have appealed that within 30 days and brought the issue up to us right then and there. The fact that it was an order discharging the defendant from probation would not have prevented that appeal.
Would not have prevented that appeal. I agree with that. But I think I would have argued in that case that the fact that they didn't object at the hearing would have given this court no jurisdiction over the appeal because they waived it.
Do you have any authority for the idea that you can waive an objection to an illegal sentence? The briefing didn't give us any. I was interested in the waiver argument, but I didn't see any authority in the briefing, and I was not able to find any doing my own research.
I have not found anything. I mean, and I tried. But I think the reality is, and I hate to keep going back to the same point, that I think the court is assuming it's an illegal sentence ad hominem. No, that's not the right word. At its inception. I forgot my Latin word there. But I think, unlike the habitual offender statutes, which there's a plethora of case law on, and the statutes are very clear, and you gives courts and lawyers something to look at that says this is the process, this is how this works. We don't have this case on this point. And I actually don't think Red House or Romero are directly on point either.
To the state's point about when can the state, there's lots of mechanisms that allow a defendant to challenge a sentence. It's unclear what the mechanisms are for the state to challenge an illegal sentence and at what point the state is required to do so. Do you dispute that the state could have raised this the day before your client was released from probation and it would have been fine?
Raised which?
The idea that the original sentence was illegal.
No, and it's like you were reading my mind, Your Honor. If you look at Red House at page 5, it's cites to Diaz, and Red House is essentially an opinion on what's the difference between Red House and Diaz. And in Diaz, the timing of the state's motion in Diaz was considerably late, having been made at the end of the defendant's prison term, whereas here the state acted expeditiously. So I do dispute the point that they could have brought this up the day before the hearing on the motion to terminate probation, because at that point, Mr. Howard had served over half his probation. He had a reasonable expectation from the date of his plea on that he would be eligible for this. And more importantly, he had a reasonable expectation from the date of his plea on that the 5-20 didn't apply because he had no notice. And that's, going back to law school, that's one of the basic provisions.
Diaz wasn't dealing with a sentence that was illegal upon its imposition. That was it, wasn't that the DWI case where defendant was sentenced for a third and the state found another prior conviction that could have been used to elevate it to a DWI fourth, something along those lines?
I thought Red House was that one, and Diaz was yeah, I'm sorry, you are correct.
The state learned. Isn't that a different thing, the idea of enhancing a sentence after the sentence is imposed versus whether the sentence was illegal at its inception? Aren't those very different issues?
May I answer that question? I'm out of time.
Please.
Okay. I don't think they are, because in essence, what the state is arguing for that was illegal about this sentence is that it should be enhanced to a greater status than what was in the plea agreement, in the judgment sentence, and in the change of plea order.
But enhancements are based on conditions that are either found by a jury, such as use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, or prior convictions that would allow you to elevate the basic sentence for an offense and enhance it with additional time. That's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with whether the correct basic sentence was imposed in this case.
I agree, but it has the same effect. I mean, what Diaz stands for is that you can't wait until, and in Diaz, the state filed their motion 2 months before she completed her term of imprisonment, which makes it analogous to the facts here, or to analogous to the court's hypothetical about the day before the motion to terminate. But what the state is doing in both cases is saying way late in the game, wait. You can't be done yet. You got to do more. And if the state, I think Diaz is a good case that sets the limits on when can the state seek to intervene to change the term of punishment, whether that's probation or imprisonment. When can they intervene? If you wait till the last minute, that has fairness, due process, double jeopardy implications. And Red House does go into some of the double jeopardy implications. It's sort of different than Romero in that instance. But Diaz, of all the cases I've found, because there's, again, not a case on point, Diaz is the one that I think more closely mirrors the practical effect of what we're dealing with here. Can the state come in at the last minute or 46 days after the last minute and say, wait, we want to change it? I don't think that's fair. I don't think that comports with due process, and I do think there's a double jeopardy issue there, because this isn't our normal double jeopardy Blockberger analysis. This has its own New Mexico case law on double jeopardy analysis. Was there an expectation of finality, and was it reasonable? And I'm way over time, but I think based on what's in the plea paperwork at the time, the order granting the motion to withdraw, and the fact that nobody brought this up until 46 days after he was done proves both the expectation and the reasonableness of that. And so if anything is retrospectively done to Mr. Howard, it is both a due process violation or a double jeopardy violation.
I have two more questions, and then I'll let you sit down. I realize you're way over time, and I don't know if my colleagues have additional questions. In this case, the hearing was set on defendant's motion within days of when defendant filed the motion. So the state didn't have an opportunity to file a written response, and potentially victims of crime. The crime were not given sufficient notice. How does that factor into whether or not the 46-day period where the state filed its motion to reconsider? I'm concerned that the initial period wasn't sufficient on the motion to terminate probation.
I'll answer that question with an analogy, if I may. Most often when a motion to revoke a probation is filed by the state, the hearing, at least the first hearing, is held within 2 or 3 days. The defendant is imprisoned at or before that hearing, and actions are taken very quickly. Probation termination / revocation proceedings usually happen at their outset in a more expeditious manner than in anything else. And oftentimes I don't have time to write a written response, but I have to be prepared at the hearing to start making a record going forward. Here, nothing prevented the state from making its arguments at the district court at the hearing. They did not file a response. The district court specifically asked them, did you file a written response? No. Do you wish to make arguments here today? The court gave them the opportunity to object. And the answer was, no, we'll defer to probation. The state said, okay, probation, what says you? We'll defer to the court. So you didn't just have, yes, the hearing was expeditiously set. I think it was 6 days, if my recollection is correct. But you had two chances by the state to say, no, this is illegal. He has to serve 5 years, a minimum of 5 years, and a maximum of 20 years. Nobody brought that up. So I don't think that that should play any role in the analysis, because they still had the chance to make an argument. You said you had two questions.
I think I only had one.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim.
So I just want to start with just a few things. First on Judge Duffy, your waiver authority, looking for authority on waiver. I think Bedez is a good one, 2002 NMCA 040. An illegal sentence is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction, which cannot be waived and can be raised at any time. So I think whether the district court mentioned something or whether the state didn't mention anything at that hearing, I think that case is controlling that this is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction of whether the district court had its authority to terminate the probation and modify the judgment and sentence. So this cannot be waived. So that argument can't really overcome Bedez. I think it was also Judge Duffy about Diaz, correct, that was not dealing with an illegal sentence. And in that case, the court was also looking at the expeditiousness of the state and when they filed their appeal. And in that one, I think the defendant had 2 months left on whatever term that, and that was a proper sentence, but had 2 months left to serve that, and the court shut that down, as opposed to here where we're looking at least, even before the statutory floor, about 2.5 years. So that brings us out of the realm with Diaz, and I think squarely within Red House. I also believe Romero is on point with the remedy. I think it's a good point to bring up that because maybe the double jeopardy concern of whether the expectation of finality, let's say Red House doesn't apply or this court doesn't want to get into the double jeopardy concerns, that Romero is a good vehicle for this court to just deal with the remedy of whether a due process concern of whether the defendant had a reasonable expectation of a 5 to 20 or under 5 year probation term. And I think that remedy was appropriate for the Romero court.
For how long can the state take this action? I understand defendant's argument to be the district court's order terminating probation concluded defendant's service of his sentence. After that, if the state, let's pretend the state disagreed and didn't acquiesce, they reasonably have 30 days to appeal that order, but the mandatory, correcting a mandatory sentence after someone has completed serving the sentence seems like an indefinite time period. I mean, it was 16 days here, but it seems like it could be forever. It could be any time that the state could come back and say, oh, wait, we were wrong, it wasn't enough time. And the line that the court has drawn in the past has been if service of the sentence is complete. And because of the nature of this order, isn't that what happened here? Why shouldn't we be worried about that?
I think those are fair concerns. But I think what separates this case is that we're dealing with an illegal sentence that was null and void. And what we're talking about with respect to that is subject matter jurisdiction. Did the district court have the authority in the first place? So if the defendant didn't serve the sentence, I think it also goes to like a slippery slope argument of handing district courts the authority. If this court were to go that, they could violate any mandatory statute they want, but afterwards.
They can't, because the state does have the opportunity to appeal that order. It's if the state didn't appeal it, which is what happened here. They didn't. And you know, so it wouldn't be, you're not standing on two slippery slopes, really, right? The slippery slope of endless state opportunity to change a sentence, and the slippery slope of district courts having unbridled authority to, without authorization, terminate sentence, right? Because the state always has the opportunity to appeal the district court's action. But if we let the state appeal this action, how is that not a slipperier slope?
Well, I think it goes to, I think there's other remedies. I think we get into mootness if it's too long. We get into double jeopardy concerns. I think we get into the time frames of whether the state has the right to appeal. So I think for that other slippery slope, I think there are other remedies this court could have. So a state doesn't bring a case years later where, you know, somebody's finished their term.
Do you agree
what I think Judge Ray is asking you is, so then what is too long? Right? Is 46 days too long? Well, is 5 years too long? Like where do we get into the mootness analysis?
Well, I can only speak to what happened here. I think that's up for this court to determine if there is a time frame, if it's going to be a black letter law of 1 year, 30 days, or something like that. That's up to this court. But I think the expeditiousness in this case, when we're talking about how the state acted in this case, within 50 days to writ the Supreme Court, get a stay, file a motion to reinstate probation, all because the victims were not present at that hearing. And as Judge Duffy reminded me, the hearing was set like 6 days after. And so that wasn't enough time for everybody to kind of get their ducks in a row.
Do you agree with defense counsel's characterization of the Supreme Court's order on the writ and the purpose of the writ?
I do not. I think the purpose of the writ, and I'm sorry, I'm going over time so I can answer this question, but I do believe that, I think what part of our writ, we brought up the Victim Rights Act issue. The victims were not present. But on the other, flip side, we also brought up the conditional discharge incorporating the sex offender probation statute. And part of the reason the writ was denied, in my opinion, is I think they want, this is an appealable issue. And they want this court to, we want to go through the appellate cycle, not by writ, determine whether a conditional discharge statute with enumerated sex offender does apply. Is that, it, you know, have case law basically on that. And issue the district court a motion to reinstate probation based on our argument we made in the writ and on the motion to reinstate probation.
So they're abandoned on appeal the Victims of Crime Act issue?
On appeal, yes. I think it's a very, I think it's a big concern the state has. I do think that the Victim Rights Act just were kind of unclear on what the remedies are, and that's for another day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. We appreciate your preparation. It's been helpful to us. We are going to take the case under advisement. We will do our best to get you an opinion as soon as possible. And with that, today we're adjourned. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.